Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
Okay, I want to start by asking you to just bring to mind times and situations when life is hard, when you're finding things tricky. Maybe, Kev, there's a bit of uncertainty in your future, or when you're starting something new and you feel a bit insecure. In moments like that, what is it that suddenly makes you feel, actually, things will be all right? I feel safe. I feel okay now in this situation. Now, there might be a variety of answers across the room, but I think one of the most common ones would be you feel like things can be okay when you find a person in that situation who can make you feel safe. There are some people out there who just have this effect. It's someone who they seem to know what they're doing. They seem to have what's uncertain for you seems to be something familiar and comfortable for them. Also, somebody who seems trustworthy, who seems like you meet them and you just see them as someone. Yeah, I trust that you are not motivated by the wrong things. Actually, you want the best for this situation. And someone who seems interested in you. Actually, they take an interest. They want to help you. So I remember when I did my teacher training and my first placement was in a school. I was terrified, okay? It's like a sheep being thrown into a den of wolves. I was this guy who I'd never been in a classroom since I was actually a kid. And there I was. And I'm like, these kids are going to tear me to shreds. What do I do? And so I was terrified going into work that morning. And when I got there, we had the kind of induction meeting, and there was a guy there called Mr. Ali. And Mr. Ali had been teaching in this school for decades, and he was the loveliest man, and he paid so much attention to all the trainee teachers, and he just helped us feel like, actually, we can do this. We're okay. We're in a place, and this will work. And he had that kind of presence about him. And there are some people, I'm sure you've met people at different points in your life who've had that kind of effect. And in today's story, we're going to meet a man just like that. Let me just bring you up to speed on the story so far. So last time I preached, we looked at chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, which is a story in the Old Testament. And what happened is you've got this man called Elimelech, and he lived in Bethlehem, which is a place in the land that God had promised, and a place where God's presence was with all of God's people. And it was meant to be a place of that in the land of milk and honey, of abundant provision. And God had spoken all these words about it. And yet there was a famine there. So Elimelech, rather than turning back to God and seeing all the people around him come back and cry out to God, they made a different decision. They decided they were going to leave Bethlehem and move to Moab. So they did. And then things went bad for the family in Moab. So Elimelech died. Also, they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They both married women from Moab, and both of the sons died as well. So you had Naomi left. She was Elimelech's wife. She was out there all on her own with these two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, and they had no way of providing for themselves. So it was a tough situation that they were in. So Naomi decided, actually, the only way that I can make life work is if I go back to Bethlehem. I've got friends there. I've got family there. They have more of a support network there. So she decided to go back to Bethlehem. But she knew then that the life she'd be asking her daughters-in-law to come into wouldn't be an easy one. So she recommended they go back to their family home with their mum and dad, brothers, sisters, whoever else was there, where they could be provided for. Now, one of them, Orpah, did what Naomi suggested. Okay, that's an absolutely fine decision to make. It's making the best of a tough situation. But then the other one, Ruth, this incredible woman, says, no, I'm sticking with you. She made a covenant to stick with Naomi no matter what. So these two women, they come back to Bethlehem. That's where we're going to pick up the story today. So I'm going to read to you chapter 2 of the book of Ruth. So if you have a Bible with you, feel free to follow along. If you don't have a Bible, feel free to listen. Okay, Ruth chapter 2. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favour. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favour in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother in your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favour in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. She ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So in this chapter, we're introduced to the next character in the story. Okay, last time we met Elimelech, we met Naomi, we met Ruth, we met some of the key people. The other main character that we've not met yet shows up right at the beginning of chapter 2, and that is Boaz. And we learn a few things about him. So in verse 1, we're told firstly that he's a relative of Elimelech. So the guy who went out to Moab in the first place, Boaz is one of his relatives. That's going to become an important detail in the story as we go through. So even by coming back to Bethlehem, we're seeing already this extended family, this support network that was there is starting to come into play for Naomi. And it says he was of the clan of Elimelech. So just to get that word clan into our heads. So in Israel, you had the tribes. So there's like the 12 tribes of Israel. They were kind of the major subdivisions of the people. And then each tribe was broken down into clans. And then the clans were broken down into families. So to say he's in the same clan doesn't mean he's directly in the same family, but it's more like he's a distant cousin. Okay, he's part of the extended family with Elimelech, but he is a relative there. We also see in verse 3 that he's a landowner. Okay, so the way the land was done, it was divided up and it was allotted to different people. And it was like there was one massive field. It wasn't loads of little fields. It was like one massive field, but there were different bits of it given to different people with like boundary markers on them. And Boaz, he owned part of it. And we can see in verse 4, he had people working for him. So he must have been fairly wealthy, a businessman in this kind of rural setting. We also learn something about Boaz in this chapter. What was he like as a man? What kind of person was he? Well, verse 1 uses a very interesting word, and it says that he was a worthy man. I just want to mull on that for a second. He was a worthy man. What does that mean? Well, we know from elsewhere in the Bible, it's not trying to claim he was perfect. It's not trying to claim he never did anything wrong. And yet it's a seriously positive thing to say about someone, isn't it? Boaz was a worthy man. Boaz is actually one of the very few people in the Bible who actually there's nothing on record of them blowing it and stuffing up and doing wrong. He just seems to be a guy who's got his life in order. Actually, saying he's a worthy man means Boaz was a guy, he's worthy of respect. He's worthy of trust. He's worthy of imitation. His life is a good example of how to live a life. It's kind of, how is he viewed in society? How do other people look at him? You know, if someone was saying, oh, I'm going to go and hang out with Boaz, would that be something that would set your heart at rest? So yeah, you'll be good. Hanging out with Boaz, that will be good for you. Or do you get all tense being like, oh, I'm not sure you should be going hanging out with him. I worry what kind of influence he will be. Boaz was a worthy man. Sometimes you meet someone. Don't know if you've ever done this. You meet someone and there's a lot to like about them. And you list the positives. I like this and I like this. And they're a good person to be around. But there's just this one thing. Have you ever thought that about someone? So that person's great, but they do have a bit of a temper. Or this person's really cool, but not when they've been drinking. Or this person's good, but the way they handle money isn't quite right. And there are other people, actually, you just respect them. You don't have a yes, but. You have a just, they're on it. They're actually living life well. And Boaz was one of those people. I've been thinking recently about some areas in my own life. I want to grow. I want to increasingly be like Boaz, okay? I don't want people to look at me and say, yeah, Tommy's a great guy to imitate, but not in this. I don't want that. I want to be like Boaz. I want to be a worthy man, a man who's worthy of imitation, of respect, and of trust. And I'd love that for you as well. Okay, Boaz, he was a worthy man. In chapter 3, verse 11, we see a similar word used of Ruth. It says that she is a worthy woman. In this story, we've got some good examples of life. And we want our lives to go in this direction. But here's the thing, to become a worthy man like Boaz or a worthy woman like Ruth, it doesn't just happen by itself. It's something actually, you've got to work on your own life. And this requires effort. It requires actually examining yourself and seeing, well, where am I at in these different areas? What are the next steps to grow? It means fighting yourself. It means discipline. It takes time. It doesn't just happen like that. It also requires humility. It requires the humility to say, actually, at the moment, I might not be like Boaz. I might not be like Ruth. And actually, if someone else raises something, to have the humility to receive it and say, okay, I see what you're saying, right? I want to grow then. I want to develop. I want to become like this. I want to be like Boaz when I grow up. That's a good phrase to have in our heads as we're trying to mature in the Christian life. Now, this isn't about legalism. This isn't saying, oh, if you get to be like Boaz, then God will love you. Okay, that's not how it works. God loves you as you are. Okay, that's not up for grabs. But this is about pressing into a godly life. It's a serious calling for all of us. We see in verses 3 and 4, Boaz honoured God. He honoured God. So Ruth had gone into Boaz's field to glean. Now let me just explain about gleaning, because this links into the Old Testament law that was given through Moses. So one of the laws, this is in Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22. This is an instruction for farmers. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, nor shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. So what he's saying is, look, when you're collecting the harvest, yeah, go and grab the harvest, but if you drop any or if there are any bits that you didn't get first time, don't go back, just leave it. And then there's something, if there's people who don't have any money, people from other places who need to eat, they can go round and they can pick up all the stuff. That was the law for gleaning, and that was what Ruth was availing herself of. So this was a legitimate way, it was like a kind of welfare system of the day. What I find fascinating, though, is that Boaz was actually doing it. Okay? Boaz was keeping the law. It's one thing to have a society where this is written, but Boaz was actually doing it. And the impression that we're supposed to get is that that wasn't all that common. Because this story started by saying it happened in the time of the judges. Now, I don't know if you've ever read the book of Judges in the Bible, but it was a pretty bleak time. Actually, it was a godless time. It was a time where people frequently turned away from what God said. It's got this catchphrase, there was no king and everybody did as he pleased. That was the time of the judges. But here's a guy, Boaz, and he's obeying God's law. I mean, even the fact that he had to say to her, look, Ruth, don't go into all the other fields to glean, stick here and you'll be all right. It kind of implies it was pretty brutal. If she went into the other fields, that would be a dangerous thing to do. And yet Boaz has created a field that's like a place of safety, a place of peace, a place of harmony. In verse 4, we see him when he's talking to his workers, he's acknowledging God in his conversations. So here's a guy who's walking with God, and he's showing it both in what he does and in what he says. He honours God. He also honours people. Okay, we get the impression that he's got a pretty good relationship with his workers, you know. He says to them, the Lord be with you. And they answer, the Lord bless you. I mean, how many times have you been to work and felt like saying the Lord bless you to your boss, okay? It means there's a good relationship in place. And also, when he gets to the field and he sees Ruth, this woman from Moab, on her own, doesn't recognize her, she's there, she's gleaning, kind of way behind everyone else, she's all on her own, he asks after her. He's noticed her and he asks the question. There are some people who make you feel noticed in a good way. It's like, this person is actually interested in me. They care about me. They care whether I'll be okay. They care that I'm here. They want to know about me. And there are other people who don't. There are other people who can be so like wrapped up in what's going on in their own head, they can make you feel pretty anonymous in a room with them. So a few years ago, I went to a parents and tots group when my eldest was a little toddler. And it was my second time there. So I'd been 1 week, had a kind of good time, came back the next week and was playing. And a lady came up to me and she started talking to me, which was nice because I didn't know anyone. And I was glad. And she said to me, like, hi, my name is, and she told me her name. And she said, is this your first time here? And I said, no, it isn't actually. And she said to me, oh, right, I don't need to talk to you then. And she walked off. And it was obviously like some kind of pep talk had happened at the start where they'd said to the team, oh, if it's someone's first time, make sure you go and talk to them. And she might not have quite got the principle what was behind it. But later during that same morning, there was another guy. He came and he started chatting to me, and he was asking me about like what I do for a living, about my job, what I'm interested in. He was sharing some of his own life with me. We had a good chat. It lasted maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes chatting while the kids were playing. And it was a really good, encouraging conversation. I felt, after those two conversations, I couldn't have felt differently about myself. One made me feel so small, like you don't want to talk to me. You're only doing it because you've been told if it's the first time talk to them, or actually you want to know me, you're interested, you care. Boaz was like that second situation. We've got here a worthy man. He's living a life honouring to God, a life that's honouring to people. I think sometimes when we read stories like this, there are two dangers that we can have, okay? And we could fall into either of them. Sometimes we can just read it and be like, oh, Boaz, he's cool, all be like Boaz, and not understand that all of the Bible is about Jesus. Okay? The other mistake that we can make is we can be so quick to say, well, Boaz is a picture of Jesus, which he is, and we're coming on to that, that we forget to look at it as like, Boaz is also a picture of Boaz. He's a picture of a guy living a godly life. And by seeing examples in the Bible of how life can be lived, That should spur us on to live that kind of life ourselves. Actually, if this is what life looks like when you're in relationship with God, when you've got your house in order, when your ducks are in a row, great, let's all be spurred on to live this kind of life. But what I want to kind of dive into really is the relationship between Boaz and Ruth in this chapter. Now, a few things to say to start with. Firstly, it's not like kind of classic rom-com world, okay? Ruth isn't looking for a Boaz, okay? She's busy being a Ruth. Ruth is awesome, okay? Ruth is absolutely incredible. We see she's just arrived in this foreign land with her mother-in-law, and she's not kind of just sitting around feeling sorry for herself. She's going out to work. She's making use of the means that are available. And it's hard work, it's dangerous work, it's lonely work, going out and gleaning in the fields. And she does it to provide for herself. She does it to provide for Naomi. She's not kicking up a fuss and acting entitled. Ruth is great. Okay, I love Ruth. I love Boaz. We've got some brilliant characters here. Also, I'm not going to tell you a romantic story. Now, that will come in chapter 3. Okay, so we will get there. But that's not what this chapter is about. This chapter is about a good bloke helping out somebody who's having a tough time. And the key idea, really, is about Ruth finding favour with Boaz. Okay, Ruth finding favour with Boaz. So in verse 2, she says, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favour." Okay, she wants to find favour in somebody's eyes. Then in verse 13, she says, "I have found favour in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." So we see this phrase, it's repeated twice, about finding favour. That's what the chapter is about. Ruth finds favour with Boaz. But intertwined around this idea of Ruth finding favour with Boaz is the idea of Ruth finding favour with God. Okay, Ruth finds favour with God. And as we look at this, it will make us think about ourselves as people who have found favour with God. Okay, God's favour is upon each one of us. We're going to think about what that means. But the two are linked together. You see how verse 12 and 13 kind of put the two ideas in harmony. "The Lord repay you for what you have done. A full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favour in your eyes, my Lord." So she's come to take refuge under God's wings. And how does that play itself out? She finds favour with Boaz. The two ideas go together. So we're going to look at what it is to find favour and see how Ruth finds favour with Boaz and what that tells us about us finding favour with God. So I'm going to start with this idea of welcome. Welcome. So verse 8, Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." He's given her an invitation to be in his field. He wants her to be there. It's like he's saying to her, "Ruth, there are lots of places you could go, but I want you to be here. This is a place where you're wanted. This is a place where you're welcome." I bet there weren't many places that a Moabite woman in Israel in those times would have felt like that. But Ruth did. You know, so some heartbreaking statistics a few years ago about international students in the UK. And the percentage was higher than I dared to think it would be, who would say, "I was in the UK for a year or more studying, and I never once had a meaningful conversation with a British person." It's heartbreaking, isn't it? The percentage was even higher who said, "I never went to the home of a British person for a meal." How would that feel? How would it feel to be in a place and yet still feel like you're on the outside, like nobody is interested, like nobody really cares? That would have been the experience of most Moabites who were in Israel in that time. Just given a wide berth, "You're an outsider, I want nothing to do with you." That look of, "What are you doing here?" At best, you'd feel invisible. At worst, it would feel like outright hostility. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling of being an unwanted outsider. Maybe if you did like what Ruth did and have moved to another country and had to experience being just different to the people who were there. Maybe it's something you've always struggled with, actually. Friendship groups have formed and you never felt like you were in one. You always felt like you were just there making up the numbers. Maybe you've got a sense that when you go to work, your colleagues just look at you and think, why are you working here? Maybe this is the biggest worry that some of you might have had before you first came to church. Actually, will I feel like the outsider? Will I feel unwelcome when I get there? But whilst this was the experience of many people in her situation, this wasn't Ruth's experience at all. And that's because Boaz noticed this Moabite girl on her own, and he gave her a place where she could be welcome and where she was wanted. And in Boaz's actions, there's something of the heart of God there. This is how God is to all of us. Actually, when we were on the outside, when we had nothing to say we should be in, he opened his arms and welcomed us in. And maybe part of the reason that Boaz was able to reflect God so well is because he'd seen this same heart of God in his own family. Because we see later on in the Bible, there are genealogies, and we see that Boaz was the son of a man called Salmon, and Salmon was married to Rahab. And now, Rahab was, when the people of God were entering the land, she hosted the spies. She was one who realized that actually the people that she lived with were wicked, were under God's judgment, and she called out to God to be saved, and she was incorporated into the people. So Boaz's mom was a foreign woman who was welcomed into the people of God. And maybe that, hearing these stories growing up, maybe that was part of what shaped Boaz to be the kind of man who, when he saw Ruth, said, I'm going to welcome you in as well. We see it throughout the ministry of Jesus. Think about Jesus with the woman of Samaria, who was at the well, and he went and approached her and asked her for a drink and opened up the most incredible, deep, spiritual conversation. While the disciples are just looking around thinking, why would he talk to her? Well, he talks to her because he wants to welcome her in. Or Jesus with the woman caught in adultery. When everyone wanted her to be stoned, he said, neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more. With Zacchaeus, who couldn't even get close enough to see and had to climb a tree, Jesus picked him out. So I'm going to come to your house for dinner tonight. He was welcoming people in who felt they had no right to be in. And just as Ruth found favour with Boaz and found favour with God, just as all those people found favour with Jesus, I want you to know this evening, okay, really know you have found favour with God. I have found favour with God. And just think about that in your mind for a second. Dwell on it. Do you ever just say it to yourself in the middle of a day when it seems like everything's against you? To be able to just say, I have found favour with God. What a powerful thing to be able to say. In Christ, there is a place for you where you're wanted and where you are welcome. Jesus told a story of a shepherd. He had 99 sheep, and there was just one that had wandered away. And what did he do? He went after that one to bring it back. That's how Jesus loves you. You're wanted, you're welcome. Jesus said, in my Father's house, there are many rooms. I will go and prepare a place for you. There's a house, there is a home, and there's a place in that home for you. This is an idea of security, peace, belonging. Jesus says, I want you and you are welcome. How much does he want you? So much that he would go to the cross, that he would give up his own life to reconcile you to the Father. That's how much he wants you. And as the people of God, this is exactly the kind of welcome that we're called to extend to others as well. We need to create places, both as we gather and wherever we are in the week, where people get this sense from us that they're welcome and they're wanted. So welcome is the first part of finding favour. Well, the second part of it that we see is protection. So I'll read verses 8 to 10. So Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Okay, we'll stop there. Just think about what Boaz is doing for her here. Firstly, he's saying, actually, you don't need to go into another field. There are places that are dangerous. I'm going to create a protection for you so you don't need to go into those places of danger. I'm going to invite you to stay near my young women. Okay, he had young women who were working for him in the field. Now, the people gleaning normally wouldn't be that close to the workers. They had to keep a distance back. But he says, no, I'll invite you. Stay close to them. There'll be safety in numbers. He says, I'll put community around you. That will help protect you. He said, I've warned the young men. Okay, there are some guys, and I've had a word with them, and none of those guys are touching you, Ruth. Okay, you're fine. Now, I don't know if that's something the guys would have been likely to do or not, but I do know it would have been very reassuring for Ruth to hear that Boaz had had a word with them and warned them off. And also said, look, when you're thirsty, you can go and get a drink. Okay, you can make use of my facilities. You can take care of the needs that you have. He protected her. Think about the vulnerability of Ruth's position. On her own, in a land far from her family, if something had happened and Boaz wasn't there, would anyone have cared? Would anyone have noticed? She was in a very vulnerable position, and Boaz is putting some rings of protection around her. Again, we see something of God in this. I read verse 12 a minute ago, but I'll read it again. This is Ruth speaking to Boaz. She said, the Lord repay you. Boaz speaking to Ruth. The Lord repay you for what you've done. A full reward be given to you by the Lord, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Again, that's an image of protection. Going for refuge under the wings. It's like an image of a bird. So part of finding favour with God means you've got protection. You've got a refuge. Now, a bird's wing is quite a powerful thing, okay? So my aunt runs like a mini farm, and she's got geese on the farm, okay? And one day the geese had like eggs with like baby geese in them. And my auntie thought the geese were up at the other end of the farm. She just wanted to have a little look and check that the eggs were okay. And she was having a look, and then Mummy Goose got back, and it saw her near the eggs, and it got its wing, and it hit her leg hard. And she was showing her leg was a massive bruise. And that made me realize birds' wings have strength. They have power to them. They're not fragile. They're not easy to defeat. And imagine a bird who's locked its wing over something. That's like a defense. It's like a bulletproof shield, isn't it? That bird has got for its young one. And there's an image here of God's protection for us like that. I wonder if you ever think of God as your protector. I have a friend who's a worship leader, a musician, and a songwriter. And one of the songs that he wrote included these lines. Shielded by love divine, hold the line, an army can't harm me at all. Lift your eyes towards the prize, mobilize, and follow our king into war. The death-defying lion roars, scripture's sharpness in his claws. Though we may be vulnerable, he is indestructible. We will survive. We will survive. So we don't often sing about that truth, do we? We don't often think about that truth, really, do we? But isn't that a biblical image? Don't you read in the Psalms that God is our shield, he's our refuge, he's our high tower, he's our protector? One of the names of God is Jehovah Roi, God, our protector. So let's think about what God's protection of us looks like. We can start in the most eternal sense. He protects us on that great and glorious day of judgment. There's a TV show that I watched a few years ago called Heroes. Has anyone seen Heroes? Okay, it's a cool show. Well, I'll refer it. Season one is cool, okay? After that, it tails off. They finish the story, but they spin it out. But basically, the premise is that ordinary members of society start waking up with different superpowers. They can't figure out what's going on and kind of all the consequences of it. And there's this one guy who basically, his superpower is he can absorb powers from other people. And he ends up absorbing this kind of exploding man power where he's going to be like a massive nuke in the city and he's going to kill everybody. Now, he doesn't want to. He's kind of absorbed this power by accident and he can't handle it. His brother also has developed power, and that is the power to fly. So the only way to save the whole city is for his brother to grab him and fly up into the sky and take the explosion upon himself. So this exploding man, this brother who's taken him, has to absorb all that explosion onto himself to save those down below him. That is a picture of what Jesus has done for us. Actually, you could call it an explosion. Think about the judgment, the wrath of God against sin. And all of us are sinners. That would be channeled at us. But Jesus on the cross took all the sin into himself. It's like he flew above the world and took the explosion, took all the judgment and wrath upon himself. Romans 5:9 tells us that we are saved by Jesus from the wrath of God. Who can stand on that final day? Well, because Jesus has taken that wrath upon himself, we can stand, we are protected, we are secure on that final day. And realizing that for eternity, we're fine, we're okay, we are in, that really helps us, because it puts us on a solid ground when it comes to other things that might be thrown at us in life, when life gets hard in other ways. Because we can remember, actually, if Jesus has put us on this solid ground, there's nothing that can knock us off the eternal purposes that God has for us. It says in Romans 8, I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. You see, life will throw things at us. Ultimately, those things can't take us down. We have found favour with God. He's our protector. He's our shield. He is our defender. And then in the middle of those circumstances, in the middle of the challenges and trials of life, we can ask God for protection in the moment. We can ask God, God, protect me. I'm going through this. And there are a number of ways that God may answer that. And I think they all kind of are here in this Ruth story, actually. So one way that God may protect us is he may take us out of a circumstance. Like when Boaz says to Ruth, don't go in any other fields. God may take us away from a place that is dangerous. Another way that God might do it is he might put us in community with others to walk through it with. You know, Boaz said to us, stay with the young women. Sometimes, actually, we're going through something on our own, and we pray. And what God does is he doesn't remove the circumstance, but he puts us with people so that we can walk it well. Another thing you might do is strengthen us in the midst of it. Like Boaz said to Ruth, look, whenever you're thirsty, whenever you're tired, go and get yourself a drink of water. He makes available strength for her. This is something God does as we ask him as well. So God welcomes us. God is our protector. The final way in this chapter we see what it is to find favor is the idea of a provider. Okay, Boaz provides for Ruth. You see, what has he done? He said to the people, look, pull out some for her. You know, as you're gathering, don't just let her get the bits. Don't actually pull out some. Make it so there's loads of stuff there for her to glean. And then afterwards, at mealtime, he says, you can come to my table. He feeds her. You know that inviting someone for a meal is a powerful way of bestowing favour. And you know what I like? Do you know what the meal is? It's bread dipped in wine. It's basically communion, CCM style, that they are doing. She sat with the reapers. She was invited in to the people who were in Boaz's household. It's like she is being privileged beyond what she is entitled to. Now think about God. Think about the great banquet to come. Think about the welcome. He's invited you to the great wedding feast of the Lamb. And actually, I made the link with communion, but as we break bread on Sundays, this is a foretaste of that. This is drawing our hearts and minds to that day. We've been invited to a feast with the Lord. When Ruth rose, it says she'd ended up with an ephah. That's 22 litres of barley. Okay, that's a lot of barley. I mean, imagine trying to get that home. Okay, she couldn't just kind of call an Uber. She had to carry 22 litres. Andy sent her home with a doggy bag of all the leftover food for Naomi to have. So we see again, Ruth has found favour here. Again, this is a picture of how we find favour with God. There are loads of pictures like this through the Bible. Think about the Israelites in the wilderness. God gave them their provision, manna from heaven. Every day he provided for their need. And Jesus told his disciples and us to pray the prayer, give us this day our daily bread, in faith that God, day by day by day, will provide for the things that we need. God provides abundantly. It says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, God will generously provide all you need. Then you will always have everything you need and plenty left over to share with others. This morning I was at one of our other sites down in Kingsway, and Colin was preaching. He was telling a story of when God had provided for his needs. And someone in his family had said to him, Colin, you always seem to land on your feet, don't you? Well, another way of saying that is, you have the favour of God upon you, don't you? And I want us to know we all have God's favour upon us. Are you worried about provision? Are you worried about money? Are you worried about the things that you need? Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Your Father in heaven knows that you need these things. All will be added to you. Our God is a God who provides amply. Ruth is a great story. Remember where we left Naomi last week? She was bitter. She was frustrated. She said, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. I'm going to live in my bitterness because God has dealt harshly with me. That's how she interpreted her life. Now see what she says in verse 20 of chapter 2. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. What a change. She was in a bitterness. She was in a frustration. Life isn't working. And now she said, the Lord's kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. What a change. What is the difference between Naomi and Naomi? She realizes that the favor of God is upon her. Bitterness, circumstances that aren't what we'd want, they are not the end of the story. And Ruth 2 shows us that something better is possible. That actually we can get caught up in frustration with what's going on. But let's lift our heads and see things through a new light. Because God's favour is upon us. God has welcomed us in. God has promised to be our protector and our provider. That changes everything, doesn't it?